The meeting of the Clinton Township Board of Education will now come to order. Time, Mr. Jeskowitz?
7:15.
Thank you, sir. In accordance with the provisions of the New Jersey Open Public Meetings Act, Chapter 231, Laws of 1975, adequate notice of this meeting was provided through the annual public notice on January 8, 2015, faxing to three newspapers designated by the board, the Hunter Democrat, the Hunter Review, the Express Times, posting on the district website, the main bulletin board, in the administrative office, and in each of the Clinton Township schools, and finally faxing to the clerk of Clinton Township. May we have a roll call, Mr. Jeskowitz?
Mrs. Grant?
Here.
Mrs. McLaughlin?
Here.
Mrs. Hand?
Here.
Mr. Malloy?
Here.
Mrs. McHugh? Mr. McTiernan?
Present.
Mr. Petuto?
Here.
Mr. Sturgis?
Here.
Mrs. Vanderoff?
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Malloy, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, sir?
Certainly.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. McTiernan, would you please be the process guardian for tonight's meeting?
Certainly.
We are going to rearrange portions of our meeting tonight. We have two presentations, so I'm going to pass the meeting over to Dr. Clark to introduce our guest this evening, and we'll have Mr. Nash's presentation first, and then we will move on to Mr. Petuto's report of his ad hoc committee that's been working on the district website. So with that said, Dr. Clark, would you please introduce our guest?
It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. David Nash, who is an attorney and authority on HIV, the anti-bullying legislation. I have taken classes with him. I know our administrators have taken classes with him, and he has presented to the board previously. Part of the requirement of the legislation is that our board maintain their training and keep up to date on all HIV legal information. And so that is what Mr. Nash is going to do here this evening. And we have invited parents. I see a huge crowd of parents. But I know there's more interest in this legislation than what we see here tonight. So I know your training is going to help us in many ways.
Thank you very much for the chance to be here. I really love the opportunity to talk with Board of Education about this law, parents about this law. Try to make sure that as we move forward, we're all doing everything we possibly can do to make this law work for all kids. So I'm excited to have a chance to talk with you today. Quick introduction for anyone who might not know. My current role is the director of the Legal One program. So in that capacity, basically, what I do is training on a whole range of school law issues. Although lately, it seems like bullying is about 80% of my training. We talk about all sorts of legal issues that schools are addressing. And very happy to be here with you. Prior to serving in this role, I served for many years as legal counsel for the New Jersey Principals and Supervisors Association. And in that role, I focused on representing school administrators when legal issues came up related to their role. So as every good attorney does, I will start with my disclaimer. I'll be providing you with some of the latest developments of the law. And as I go, I would encourage anyone who has questions, please jump in with questions that you have. Please don't take what I'm giving you as legal advice and information regarding the law. If you want a board attorney for any sorts of specific incidents that may arise. But I do want to help you understand some of the latest developments regarding the law. So I thought what we would address today really falls into three categories. What are some of the latest developments regarding New Jersey's anti-bullying statute? A review of some of the basics of the law to make sure that we're all on the same page as far as the definition of bullying, the procedures, the rights that students and parents have in this process, making sure that all of us are on the same page as far as those definitions and procedures. try to oversee the implementation of this law and provide feedback on areas where we might want to improve how the law is being implemented. We are very fortunate the executive director for the New Jersey Principals and Supervisors Association, our umbrella organization that I work for, is the chairperson of the governor's task force. And that task force has been very active, reaching out to the educational community and getting feedback from every stakeholder about how the law is working, what's working well, areas where we need to improve. So there is a very active dialogue going on about potential changes to the administrative code related to this law. And I do expect that some of those changes will be adopted at some point in the 2015-16 school year, probably by spring of 2016. So I want you to be aware of some of the changes that are out there, and I'll touch on some of those as we go through our presentation. The task force has continued its work. There are a set of additional recommendations that were made by the task force in January of 2015 that address a number of important initial issues that are now being considered by the Commissioner of Education, by the Attorney General's Office, by the State Board of Education. So some of the recommendations that I expect will be implemented. One of the things the task force talked about was the idea that bullying, all the research tells us that bullying involves an imbalance of power between students. It's different from a typical conflict between kids. Most of the disagreements, most of the issues that happen between students in school are typical conflict between kids. It's something that we have become very good at recognizing, addressing, and dealing with. But we do have those issues that are much more one-sided, where one student is being targeted. And that's why the issue of understanding power imbalance is so important. Unfortunately, the legislature did not specifically include the concept of power imbalance when they adopted New Jersey's Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights.
So the task force that was appointed by the governor has made a recommendation to try to help the field understand what a power imbalance is
and help the field identify where true bullying is occurring. I think this concept is very useful, and I'll give you an example of where we might have a power imbalance. Perhaps you have a new student coming into the school. Student transfers from another district, does not yet have friends in the school community.
And for whatever reason, a student decides they don't like this new student who's coming in, and decides that perhaps we're going to isolate this student, we're going to ostracize this student. We have a classic power imbalance because you've got a student who doesn't have a support network yet, a student who's coming into a new community, and a group of other students who are saying, we're going to try and isolate this new student coming in. That is an example where we may have bullying going on, but it's not one of the classic bullying scenarios that we would think of. Some people might say, well, how can we force kids to be friends? How can the idea that some kids are choosing not to talk to another student be a form of bullying? But the research tells us that ostracizing a student, isolating that student, not acknowledging in basic ways that student can be very harmful to a student. And we are seeing that as a form of bullying. So in that example, the power imbalance involves a student who's new, coming into a community, who doesn't yet have a support network, who's being isolated. And under New Jersey's law, the distinguishing characteristic that would be involved is the fact that this is a new student in the school. Some people in implementing the law had made the mistake of thinking that when we're looking at why a student is being bullied, it had to be a specific characteristic such as race, ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation, gender expression. But New Jersey has said that we have another broad category called other. And under that broad category of other, a student who's being singled out because they're the new kid in school can certainly meet the definition of bullying.
Excuse me, Mr. Nash, can I ask a follow-up right here?
Please.
Follow-up to that. So taking that example, is our district required to report a new kid who's not talking to anybody or is not being spoken to? I mean, how do we do that?
So obviously you're gonna have new kids who come into a community who perhaps are shy, take a while to make friends, and that in and of itself is not a form of bullying and not something that needs to be reported. But perhaps another student comes to you, as you as the principal, you as an administrator, you as a teacher, and says, Johnny is, this group of kids is isolating Johnny. Now you have reason to believe it's a concerted effort. It's not just a shy kid who's having trouble making friends.
So there needs to be a basis that there's a concerted effort not to alienate that one person.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, absolutely. In many respects, we don't want to lose our common sense in implementing this law. Some kids are shy, and it just takes a while to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not what we're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
So that is an important concept, though, the idea of power imbalance. And it helps us identify other characteristics. So for example, you might have a student who perhaps the family income is not as high as others, and that student can't afford the nice clothes or the nice shoes that another student has. And perhaps the student is being singled out because they don't have the nice clothes that somebody else is wearing. That can be the distinguishing characteristic, and you could have a power imbalance based on socioeconomic status and the fact that this student is relatively not
supervisor, to manager, to director, et cetera. Yet here we're going roughly to the highest administrative organization within the school system. Why wouldn't the first step be a discussion with, I don't have an answer, but the teacher, administration, vice principal, principal, instead of going right to the board?
So the statute builds in certain required steps. And there's lots of potential reasons. It's hard for me to get behind the thinking. But I can say that, at least for some, there was a concern that perhaps we don't have enough transparency in the process, and perhaps this needs to go right to the Board of Education. I think that concern is misplaced. I think the best practice is to have a climate where a parent feels that they can talk to a teacher, a parent feels they can talk to a teacher, and can work through that process. I'm sure for the vast majority of your parents,
and has done a great deal of good, but there are some provisions in there, like that one, that I think are not as well thought out as they should have.
Can I ask a quick question?
Please.
So it's a recommended 45-day, but
yes.
Are you saying there is no statute of limitation?
There is currently no statute of limitation, and a parent could ask for a hearing about an issue that happened 3 years ago.
Is that the max or not?
No, there is no max.
There is no max.
The law was changed in 2011, so anything that's happened since that point in time, a parent could ask for a hearing. And obviously that's not a very practical process. We should have some reasonable parameters on requesting those hearings. Another provision that's going to be clarified is that the law does deal with any allegation that a teacher or an administrator or other staff member may have engaged in harassment, intimidation, or bullying towards students. We do occasionally have allegations of that occur. In those cases, there are lots of extra complications. Obviously, we don't want an anti-bullying specialist who might be a guidance counselor to be investigating these school principals. That's a way to do a conflict of interest issue. So I know the district does have an alternative process for handling that if we have a staff member with the allegation is raised. If you want to avoid even the appearance of a conflict when you're investigating the staff member who might be involved. So ideally, you always have an administrator and somebody at a higher level than the person who's accused of doing that investigation. As far as the issue of investigating, as far as the issue of discipline as part of a student record, there is a legitimate concern that many parents have that if a child is found to have engaged in HIV, that this will follow the student and be part of that student's record. And there's a concern that perhaps, you know, down the road it could impact when students are applying for colleges and you know, looking at other opportunities beyond their K-12 education. So we did ask, or the task force did ask for some clarification on that issue, and the Department of Education declined to provide any clarification on the issue. So where the law currently stands on discipline is that there is no mandate for discipline records to be maintained. But if your school district maintains discipline records, and you do, we must maintain bullying records for that child as long as they are educationally relevant. And our courts have said that if you have bullying issues that occur at the elementary level and perhaps continue into the middle or high school level, you may have a pattern going on. So it's really critical to maintain that information for kids. So it is, I think, appropriate for us to maintain discipline records, including bullying records for kids, as they move up through our system, so that you have full information.
So we have a K district. So is the expectation then when they graduate in eighth grade, we can dispose of those records?
No. The expectation when the child completes eighth grade is that you will send the discipline records to wherever the student is going to high school. New Jersey has actually put that into the law that discipline records, if they exist, they do for your district, must follow the child when they move on to the next level. And the reason for that was put in place was to allow the administration at the next level to have a full picture of the child, not to prejudge the student, but to fully understand any issues that might have come up involving that student. Same thing is true if a student transfers in from another district in New Jersey. You are supposed to be receiving that student's discipline records at the same time you receive the education records. I can tell you that not every district does that. There are districts that drop the ball and do not send those discipline records, but they are supposed to follow the child.
Thanks.
How long do they follow the child? I understand from K through 8, we would be responsible for sending those records off to high school. Is the high school then responsible for sending that on to college?
No. The parent has the right to determine that discipline records will not be shared with colleges. The parent would actually have to authorize those records being shared with colleges so they could be shared. So once we get beyond high school,
when the child moves from K through 8 to high school, who in the high school is authorized to review or see those records?
The test under federal law and state law is the individuals who have a legitimate educational interest. So obviously that would include principal, vice principal, teachers, potentially that are working with that child. To be a case manager if you have a student who's got a learning disability. So on a case-by-case basis, we need to determine which staff members have a legitimate educational interest in those records.
Is it fair to say that they have a direct educational relationship with that child?
Not always. The majority of people who have legitimate educational interest have a direct educational responsibility. But the federal government has clarified, for example, let's say a student is still, and the student has anger management issues, and there are some strategies for addressing those anger management issues. That portion of discipline record may be appropriate to share with others, even including the bus driver. seen the entire issue. It clearly does not meet the definition of bullying under New Jersey law. And the recommendation that was made by the task force is that the principal should be allowed to make a threshold determination. Does this need to be formally investigated under the bullying statute? The commissioner at the Department of Education were very supportive of that recommendation. The attorney general's office, not yet. The attorney general's office is not convinced that that fully complies with the intent of the statute. So as of right now, if there is an allegation of bullying, it must go through the formal process all the way through the Board of Education. I do think that as a common sense measure, there are times where we have incidents that clearly do not meet the definition. And our hope is that at some point the administration will sign off on allowing that. Just to make sure we're all on the same basis when it comes to understanding the bullying law, just a quick review of the elements of New Jersey's anti-bullying bill. In order for you to have anything identified as harassment, intimidation, or bullying, we must meet the three key elements that are outlined here. We must have something that either has resulted or is likely to result in substantial disruption or interference with the operation of the school or student rights. Something that involves an actual or perceived characteristic as the motivating factor behind the behavior, and at least one of these other three conditions, physical or emotional harm to the student or the student's property or fear of that, or something that is insulting or demeaning to the student or a group the student is a part of, or something that's so severe that it actually creates a hostile educational environment that interferes with that student's ability to receive an education. And we do have cases that obviously meet all these criteria, but we have had some mistakes in districts where there have been determinations that bullying has occurred and we're not able to answer what was the distinguishing characteristic. And that would be a mistake. Without specifically being able to identify the characteristic involved, we can't determine that something meets New Jersey's bullying law. Other states sometimes don't require us to identify the characteristic, but New Jersey does. So that means as part of the investigation, we need to figure out what is motivating the student's behavior. What is it that is leading one student to single out another student to do something harmful to that other student? And occasionally, it doesn't happen often, but occasionally we run into a situation where we simply can't determine the motive. And we don't know why one student is being mean to another student. And despite our best efforts, if it's just not possible to determine that motive, what we have in that case is a code of conduct violation. And there still should be disciplinary consequences for the student. But we can't label it a bullying issue without determining what the motivating characteristic is. That was involved in that case. Hazing is an issue that is much more prevalent. But we are aware that potentially incidents could happen as early as the middle school grades, potentially even earlier, where there's something akin to a hazing ritual. So the whole idea here is that we should not have students being forced to go through some sort of ritual to prove they belong. We have had some major issues, almost all at the high school level, where students have been singled out, have been forced to go through very inappropriate rituals in order to become accepted. So I would just urge you to keep in mind that it is possible for us to have these issues, at least at the middle school level, grades 6, 7, 8, certainly we have issues like this. And you want to be sensitive and with any kind of club, any kind of team, to make sure that we're not asking kids to go through anything like this in order to feel like they are now accepted as part of a group. The high school issues that we've seen, or the allegations we've seen in Sayreville and other school districts were obviously very, very serious and involved criminal issues as well. An issue that certainly is directly on point for you is the issue of special education. So we could have, in some cases, a student with a disability who's the victim of bullying. And the student has gone through a very difficult process. You've investigated. You've determined that that student was the victim of bullying. The federal government has recently sent out guidance that says we have to act differently than we would have in the past if a student with a disability is the victim of bullying.
So now there is a very specific requirement that we must convene the IEP team and determine whether or not the bullying behavior has impacted that student's ability to receive a free and appropriate public education. How might that happen? Student is so traumatized by what occurred that the educational strategies that worked before are not working now. And there's a need for additional counseling, there's need for additional supports, there's perhaps a need for a different approach in working with that student. Unfortunately, we have some bullying incidents that are that serious that it could lead you to have to change your educational strategies or supports that you're providing for a student. So in the past, what would happen generally was that school districts would work with the case manager for that student and would make sure that the student's needs were being met. What has to happen now is that the full IEP team, including the parent, must be convened to make sure that we fully consider any possible impact on this child's education. So it's a more formal process than we had.
When must that happen, the convening of the team, upon finding?
So once you have finished the investigation and determined that the student with a disability was the victim of bullying, then you need to convene the team.
After the determination.
Yes. So it's only after the determination has been made. The federal government did not give a specific timeline for convening that team, but obviously you'd want to do it in a timely fashion. Certainly it shouldn't be months. It should be probably no more than a couple of weeks before that team is convened to make sure that we're addressing the needs of that student. And I do want to stress that this requirement only applies where the student with a disability was the victim of bullying. It may be a very good practice in lots of other cases if a student with a disability happens to be the aggressor to also convene the IEP team because there may be a need for something different in that student's IEP as well. But it's not a requirement under the federal law.
That's along lines of my question. If the student with a disability is the aggressor, are they typically right now treated the same way as like a regular ed student or a student that does not have an IEP? If they were the aggressor, do they go through the same thing?
They certainly go through the same investigation process because obviously we don't want any children being harmed. So,
no, right. But
yeah. So after that process is finished, the federal guidance does not require you to convene the entire IEP team if the student with a disability was the aggressor. I would suggest that in many cases it's a good practice to convene that team anyway. Because remember, if the behavior was a manifestation of that student's disability, there are some very specific limitations on any disciplinary action that could be taken. So it's important for you to know that. Even if you're not approaching the 10-day limit where a student has had suspensions, it's important information for you to have whether the behavior is a manifestation of that student's disability. Okay. So I would think probably in most cases it's a good practice to convene a team anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
A moment on the rights of parents. It's very important that parents fully understand their rights in this process. And parents do have very clear, specific rights that are built in. So for example, once you determine that there is an allegation of bullying, the principal should contact the parent of the alleged bully and victim and let them know that this process is starting, the investigation process. Sometimes that's a difficult phone call to make on either side of the equation because parents naturally want to know everything right up front. Their child may have been victimized, there may be an accusation against their child, and they're going to want all the information up front, and you're not going to have it yet. But the law does require us to provide that initial notice to parents. And generally speaking, it's a good practice to provide that notice the same day. The statute does not specifically mandate that, but as a good practice, you wouldn't want a child going home and be the one to tell their parent that they may have been the victim of bullying. You'd want the administrator to be the one who's made that call first before the student is gone home. So that is something built into the law. The law also requires a formal notice to the parent no later than 5 days after the Board of Education meeting where you have been informed about the issues involving that bullying incident. In the interim, there may be other steps that you choose to take to inform parents about the status of the investigation. Those are district decisions that you make. They're not required under the law. But again, as a matter of good practice, it is helpful to keep a parent informed of the status of an investigation as you're working through the process. Parents also, as we said, have a right to a hearing before the Board of Education. And if they ask for that hearing, it has to be held within 10 days of when they request it. If a parent were to request a hearing and there was no board meeting scheduled within that 10-day time period, you would have to schedule one, unless, of course, the parent agreed to a later date for the hearing. So we do want to make sure that parents understand that as well. One issue that does often come up, you might have a student who you need to interview as part of a bullying investigation. And the question is, can you interview that child if the parent is not present? And the U.S. Supreme Court 40 years ago decided yes. It would not be practical, it would not be feasible for us to have to wait to have parents present and prior parent permission every time we needed to talk to a child. Just a basic common sense point when it comes to doing investigations. We have always said that it's very important that we avoid opinion, we avoid editorializing, that when we're reporting issues, it's critical to get the facts. So we want to make sure that we are laying out specifically what the facts are or what the alleged facts are in a particular case, and leave any sort of editorializing or opinions on the side. We do want to remember that when it comes to substantial disruption or interference, it only has to be for one student. So a student is afraid to come to school, they're embarrassed, that can be the substantial disruption or interference. And sometimes the student who's the victim doesn't want to admit that they're the victim. They're already embarrassed by the issue, they're afraid that the issue might get worse. So sometimes you will ask a student if they've been victimized and they might say no. And the rest of your investigation might tell you that they are a victim. So there are times where you will choose to determine a student was victimized, even if they don't want to admit to it, depending on the facts. Some of the case law out there, just to broadly give you an idea how broadly we define distinguishing characteristic. Student with lice who was singled out by another student, commissioner did say that was a distinguishing characteristic, even though it was a temporary condition. There was no defense that the student who singled the other student out was being truthful. Parents tried that argument. That, well, my child was just telling the truth. This is the girl who came to school with lice. And commissioner said, no, some truths are meant to cause harm or meant to cause embarrassment. And certainly that was still a form of bullying. As I said, if there's no distinguishing characteristic, we do not have a bullying issue that we can define, even if it's a very serious incident in every other way. Principal's role is critical. Obviously, the principal leads the school and has to make sure that every step of that investigation process is being followed. The anti-bullying specialist is the lead investigator, and that is a role that is a challenging one. So when the alleged bully and victim are being interviewed, it's critical that the anti-bullying specialist is taking the lead in that process and making sure that every aspect of the investigation is being handled properly. I won't go through step by step the investigation process, but I'm happy to answer questions if you have any regarding how that process works and the different steps that are involved. It's a pretty elaborate process that has very clear documentation each step of the way. So I'll jump. Some special circumstances that might come up. A staff member is accused of bullying a student. In a case like that, again, you're going to want an administrator or someone at a higher level than that staff member to be the one doing the investigation to avoid any conflict of interest. We mentioned that a parent could ask for a hearing even after the board has voted to affirm, reject, or modify a bullying decision, and that hearing could be asked for, you know, 1, 2, 3 years after the fact. That is likely to change, but currently there is no time limit. The parties involved in a bullying investigation might ask that we just all sit down and mediate and work it out. That's an understandable instinct, but as long as there is an allegation of bullying, we cannot try to mediate those issues. That would potentially be re-victimizing the victim in those cases. Another special circumstance that could come up is the use of an electronic device. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that searching somebody's electronic device, their cell phone, their iPad, whatever it might be, is akin to searching somebody's home. And obviously there's lots of personal information that is very sensitive that could be on that device. So the lesson that comes out of some of the recent U.S. Supreme Court cases is that we want to look for other ways to gather information that could determine whether or not a student was involved in an HIV incident. The searching of the electronic device should be a last resort if we're not able to determine that information through other means. You do have the right, as long as there's reasonable suspicion that the electronic device was being used as part of the bullying, to do that search, but it should be our last resort. If law enforcement is involved in investigating an allegation, we do have to respect their role. They could ask us to stop an investigation. In those cases, the anti-bullying specialist would still submit a report to still indicate that the issue has been addressed. We simply say we're not yet able to reach a conclusion because law enforcement is involved in criminal investigation.
Mr. Nash, interesting point. At what point should our bullying coordinators then, or our bullying administrators, determine that it's appropriate or that they have appropriate cause to actually look at a phone or a tablet? And at what point should they back off and leave it to law enforcement?
If you have, let's say, luckily this doesn't happen so much in our high school students, but let's say you have an
I have a five-year-old with a phone.
the example I'm going to give is an explicit image being sent, right? It could happen with those police students. So you find out that there was an explicit image sent. Clearly there are potential criminal issues involved. And that's a time that you would turn that part of the investigation over to law enforcement. Most issues involving electronic devices do not have a criminal element to them. So in most situations, it would be up to the administrator to determine, is there another way for us to gather information? So another way might be, if there's a cyberbullying issue, kids who were victims or witnesses to come forward and show you what was posted. If for whatever reason that's not possible or doesn't give you a full picture and you've ruled out getting the student to simply confess to what they've done, they won't do that, there may be now a justification for you to search that phone because you've ruled out other less intrusive means to get the same information involving that cyberbullying. Now, if you have reasonable suspicion to believe the phone was used as part of the cyberbullying or the electronic device, you would have the right to search that device.
Okay. Thank you.
Social media issues, bullying issues involving kids have come up occasionally involving staff members. So there was a case where a first grade teacher in Patterson had a very bad day, came home and posted on Facebook, "I feel like I'm a warden to future criminals." And the Patterson School District was not very happy about that, thought that undermined the teacher's ability to be a teacher, wrote tenure charges. Similar result with a Union Township high school teacher who on her own time made comments about homosexuality and sin and streets about cancer. Our district is not like a neighboring district where everybody has two mommies and two daddies, or two daddies, and you know, we shouldn't accept this immoral or natural behavior. Teacher argued this was her First Amendment right to express her religious views. The school district said it undermined her ability to be a teacher in that district and for the kids to feel safe, and she was terminated as well. So there are times we're starting to see it in the evolving case law where disciplinary action is being taken for comments that are being made on social media outside the school environment by staff members. And certainly by students as well, if they are comments that are harmful to other kids. The research tells us, this is not surprising, that cyberbullying is very prevalent. 43% of students in one study reported being the victims of cyberbullying. 81% said other cyberbullying that they think is funny. 80% of teens said they do not have internet rules, or if they have rules, they know how to get around them, and their parents don't know what they're doing. Only 11% of teens said they discuss cyberbullying with their parents. So if our parents are not active in initiating these discussions, in many cases they won't happen. Parents need to become active, need to understand their forms of social media and cyberbullying that are out there, and need to get comfortable in a world where kids might be much more comfortable than they are.
issues. The research tells us that 1 in 6 students by the high school level, smaller percentages at the middle school level, but a significant percentage do consider suicide, and bullying can be one final triggering event. It's almost never the sole cause for a student who considers suicide, but if a student has underlying mental health issues, it could be the final trigger. And those underlying mental health issues that start to play out usually at the high school level have oftentimes been undiagnosed at the elementary and the middle school levels. So it's very important when staff members start to see changes in behavior that they reach out to the principal, they reach out to a counselor, they reach out to somebody and talk about the change in behavior they're seeing. Make sure that we're not having kids fall into cracks. We might have some underlying issues that need help. LGBT issues raise important concerns.
Question. Something came up where a parent recently called me with a concern that they had heard from another parent, all right, who had a child in a different school district. What is our obligation? I gave them some advice about where to go and how to handle that. They said that possibly one of our students might be involved. I asked them to contact the parent that they heard this from and have them call their school, maybe our school. What is the correct approach to take in something like that?
So what you outlined as far as the advice you gave is really right on the target with the approach that we take. The Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights does not give us jurisdiction to punish a student from another school district who may have been involved in bullying a student from your school. That's beyond the authority of the district and beyond the reach of that statute. The best we can do in those cases is communicate with the other district and do what we can to work with the student, counsel the student, address the issue in that way, but it's beyond our authority.
If it turned out that it was one of our students who was the alleged bully, then we would investigate it at our school, even though it's off campus, had to do with an outside agency, nothing to do with the school itself.
So if both students were your students from your school district?
No. I think one of them might have been ours. We're trying to find out right now. So one of them might have been ours. One of them was outside.
In those cases, the Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights does not apply. It does not cover students from one school district who may have been bullying a student from another school district. In those cases, the best we can do is to communicate and share information across districts to make sure that talking to the students, who are counseling the students, who are working with them. We're not going to have the ability to in any way discipline that student. Unless, of course, they were engaging that inappropriate behavior during a school-sponsored function. So let's say there was some sort of a competition going on between two different schools. And during that competition, one of your students acted inappropriately to a student from another school. Then under your code of conduct,
thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Nash?
Thank Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nash.
Thank you.
John, ready? I'd like to move on to the report of the ad hoc committee that was reviewing our website, the district website. Mr. John Petutto was the chair of that committee. His committee has been working for quite some time now, and he'll present this evening the report of his committee. Mr. Petutto?
So it was about a year ago where the ad hoc committee for the website, the district website, was created. And Ms. Brand actually addressed and contacted me, asked me to chair the committee. The committee was formed that to really look at the effectiveness, thank you, at the effectiveness and the functionality of the district website. How well was it working? Did it meet the needs of not only the parents but the teachers as well? And we came together with a committee that was made up of a number of members from the Board of Education, a number of staff members, as well as parents from the district. So this is a listing of the members. It includes myself, my fellow board member, Rachel McLaughlin, two staff members, Tim Jaw and Lisa Miller, Karen Smith, who was a PTA representative, and some parents, including Andrea Stevens, Julie Sieber, Joe Pecora, and Maureen McCann. When we first got together, the first thing we wanted to do was identify some statistics about the website. And utilizing some online sources that gave us information, we determined that roughly 2,000 to 3,000 page views a day were occurring on the website. That's quite significant. If you consider roughly 3 or 4 page views per person, you're talking about several hundred visitors to the website on average every single day. What was interesting is that we then took a look at the actual statistics of where those visitors were going. And as you can see on the pie chart above, 70% of the visits went directly to the teacher wiki pages. Again, pretty significant. 22% went to the parent portal, about 5% went to the calendar, and roughly 3% went to the other pages. Now, I pulled the number of pages on the district website, and there are several hundred pages. So to consider that, out of all those pages, the vast majority go between the parent portal and the teacher wikis is actually pretty interesting. It shows you the nature of where people are going and how they're utilizing the website. After we determined what the statistics were of the website, we decided to see how we were going to, what the scope of our committee was going to do beyond that. We came up with 5 areas that we wanted to focus on. The first was the overall website functionality. How is it working for the visitor? Accuracy of the content, pretty self-explanatory. We wanted to make sure that the content on the website was not only accurate, but was updated on a regular basis. Ease of navigation and searchabilities. As good as a website's content can be, it's not helpful if you can't find that information. So we wanted to identify how easily the website functioned in that regard. And then the processes and procedures for adding and updating content. That relates to the webmaster duties. Who was responsible for the website, updating it, how many people had access to updating the data, et cetera. And then finally, the connectivity for the parents, the students, and the teachers. Not only accessing the website over a computer, perhaps accessing it on their mobile device or tablet, and how that functionality worked as well. So after we as a committee went over these 5 areas, our next step was to develop a public survey. And I'm going to actually pass over the presentation to Tim Jaw. He's going to go over the first section of the public survey and what we discovered on that. Tim?
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. So last spring, we developed a public survey, and we looked at 2 of the things from our list of 5 things within the scope of the committee, the site navigation and the site content. And there were 379 total participants in the 11-question survey and over 170 comments made. Of the 379 participants, 71% of those were district parents with at least 1 child in the school district, and 23% of the participants were CTSD staff members. As you can see below, that's the breakdown of the participants and where their children are enrolled in the district. Taking note that Round Valley has a greater percentage, being the largest school, grade level wise. So I'm going to go over some of the questions that we had on the survey regarding the site navigation. So we asked people if they were able to find what they were looking for on the site with the current navigation. And as you can see from this slide, about 77% were able to at least partially find or find exactly what they were looking for, which seems like it's pretty good. But let's take a look at the deeper data. We asked a question how people would grade the overall district website. And as you can see from the chart above, we average in the B, C range. We kind of said it comes out to about a C plus, which to us showed an opportunity for growth in the use of the website and the navigation of the website.
Could be an optimist to say B minus.
Okay, we asked people to rank the site, different aspects of the site navigation. And I'm just going to read this for you since it's kind of small up there. So the five things were organization of content, search functions, menus, overall website layout and design, overall website navigation. And as you can see from the chart, we averaged about a 3 with the search functions being slightly lower than 3 on all of those, which shows that we're about middle of the road and kind of backs up the information that was presented on the previous slide. So this is where things got interesting. We had several opportunities on the survey for people to share open-ended comments about the website. And when it came to aspects of the site's navigation, many of the comments had a theme of being complicated or too cumbersome to navigate the website. And I just want to point out a couple of things in the comments that are posted up here, and that will be on the next slide. But some of the things that jump out are too many choices, menus that are too complicated, too many layers to the menus. On this side, things like too many clicks, keeping it simple, and making it more user-friendly so that someone doesn't have to click multiple times to find what they're looking for. I'm going to turn the mic back over to John, who's going to talk about the portion of this.
So the second part is to indicate was looking at the content of the website and asking our visitors a certain number of questions related to the content. So similar to the navigation area, we actually asked information on 10 specific areas of content. And I'm going to read each one of them in case you can't read them. The first part is district-specific information, PTA information, school-specific content, the staff directory, Board of Ed info, resources for the parent and student resources, notices and alerts, the virtual backpack, calendar, and the teacher wikis. And I'm sorry, so as you can see, for the most part, everything was rated roughly a 3, with the notices and alerts coming in a bit ahead of 3, and the teacher wikis coming in a little below. And keep in mind that the teacher wikis is virtually where all the visitors are going to, at least 70% of them, so that's actually interesting to see. The actual numbers behind each one of those are listed above. So again, you can see that roughly 19% of the content was rated either poor or below average, not necessarily the greatest figures, as you can see. Similar to the navigation section, we had a content public survey content section where people could add comments, and we received 33 comments on the contents of the website. Most of them, as you're going to see on this page and the next, were actually related to comments about the teacher wikis. The wikis are not always updated. Staff directory needs to be more specific as to what the teachers teach and include email addresses and extensions. Calendar entries are often lack specific information. There's inconsistent information. Teachers need to keep their wikis updated if they are to be of any use at all to the parents and students. The teachers' wikis need to be updated. The teachers' wikis are only as helpful as what they put on the site. I know it may seem like we were just targeting the wikis with the content comments, but actually that's what the majority of them were, so we wanted to show that that's where the information was coming in, and that was the concern of the people taking the survey. So we concluded the survey with another comment section for the visitors, and we received 40 suggestions on how a visitor might be able to see here, a lot of them are just specifically improving the content and improving the navigation. The first one stands out.
The website is in need of a layout and organizational overhaul. I'm not a website expert, so I don't know exactly what to suggest. All I can say is that it is usually hard for me to find what I'm looking for. And if I do find it, it's not at all where I would have expected. And that sets the tone for a lot of the comments we received. A lot of them indicated people were having a lot of trouble finding the information, and when they did find the information, it was either out of date, it was inaccurate, or irrelevant. So here are a few more comments that were made. Discontinue wikis and incorporate feature websites with the district website. There's a large amount of information on many of the pages. Sometimes it seems like if it was laid out in a more visual manner, it may be a little easier to look at the information. So again, very specific to the layout, the content, and the navigation of the site. So what are our recommendations? We thought a lot about this, and we came up with four distinct recommendations. The first one pertains to the layout of the website. So we feel it does need to be revised. Right now, there are menus on the left side of the page, the right side of the page, up at the top of the page. There are links on the bottom. There's no cohesive manner in how the website is laid out, so it needs to be addressed. Within revising the layout, we have three suggestions. First of all, I should state that the current platform that the website uses is known as WordPress, and we've been on this platform for a couple of years. So the first suggestion would be we either start over with WordPress. We take the current platform, we get a new template, and we start from scratch. Another thing we could do is simply revise the current WordPress template. So take what we have today and try and modify it so it becomes a little more cohesive and makes a little more sense and is a little better from a navigation point of view. The third option is to start from scratch, identify a new platform, determine if there's something out there that's better than WordPress, that meets our needs better, utilize that, and start from scratch and build a new website. The second recommendation relates to the content. The content should be consistently updated and refreshed. Out-of-date information should be removed or archived. Pretty straightforward. We need to keep an eye on the content. We need to identify when it needs to be removed or archived and make sure that it is obviously accurate. The third, not surprisingly, teachers should be encouraged to update their wikis regularly given the overwhelming importance and the response we received on this topic. So again, so many parents go to the wikis. So many parents indicated they want to see the wikis updated, so I think this is a no-brainer. We should look to see how we can accomplish this. Finally, it comes to the centralized webmaster duties. Who's in charge of the website? Who's in charge of updating it? We need to identify a person or persons who will control the content, will update the website, and be able to identify when things need to be changed. Because at this point, it doesn't seem like there's one person in charge, perhaps too many cooks in the kitchen handling the website, and that's probably leading to a lot of the confusion and inconsistent data. So that ends my presentation. I want to open it up to the board for any questions. Kevin?
Hi, thank you for the presentation.
Sure.
Regarding the recommendations, recommendations two or three seem like ongoing. They can be implemented at any time and they're cost-free, but vis-a-vis recommendations one and four, reviewing our web platform and a webmaster, do you have an implementation timeline and are there any costs attendant?
So if we go to a new platform, obviously there could be new costs, and I believe we're actually investigating a potential new platform at this time. As far as the timeline, obviously the sooner the better, but we'd have to identify